Well, good morning. It's good to be back here with you again. I really appreciate the invitation to come and look forward to our morning together. This evening, I'll be preaching in Virginia Beach with Josh Henson, who's one of our graduates, and I'm looking forward to that. I've never been to his church before. It is interesting that I was thinking about, as I was preparing for this Sunday school lesson, was thinking about the Anabaptists and Dr. Godfrey series. I watched it several years ago, and I don't remember disagreeing with anything that he said, but I also don't really remember what he said about the Anabaptists. So I might overlap with him. And actually, Mike, I didn't remember that we did a podcast on the Anabaptists either. Maybe we should just play that. I don't know. But I want to say a few things to you. First off, as has already been mentioned, we are not Anabaptists. And we as particular Baptists, Reformed Baptists, don't have any direct connection with them. But I don't think that we've always heard the full story. There are some parts of the story that have been left out. And I think that even though we don't have any connection to these people, there's a sense in which we ought to honor their memory. And I want to tell you why. I want to give a positive picture of them, because oftentimes they're presented as sort of a wild, undisciplined bunch. And you've heard those stories of Thomas Munzer and the peasants' rebellion that Luther was involved in and Luther opposed. And you probably have heard the stories of the disaster, and it really was that, in the northern German city of Munster. And all of that is true. But I want to suggest to you that there is another side to the story that needs to be heard, other things that need to be said. And what I want to do is talk for a little while about the earliest Anabaptists and say some things about them that make me really appreciate who they were and what they did. And I hope that you will enjoy this as well. Really, the place where we turn our attention is to Zurich in Switzerland in the 1520s. And there are five men, all of whom, and their wives as well, but especially these five men, all of whom were involved in one way or another with Ulrich Zwingli, the great reformer of Zurich, who adopted Anabaptist principles, and every one of them was martyred for the cause. Every one of them, all five of these. Now, you know, the way that the story is usually told is that the Anabaptists were uneducated peasants, or maybe some from the middle class. They didn't have any experience, they didn't have any knowledge, and that's why they were so undisciplined and they developed strange views. I want to suggest to you that that's true, but here's the but. These five men that I will talk about right now were men who were intellectuals. They were men who were highly trained. They were university graduates. They were sometimes the sons of important people in Zurich, in that town. And so this earliest group of leaders were not the peasants, but they were intellectuals who had been well-trained and well-prepared and who understood what was going on around them. In fact, several of them were in Zwingli's inner circle for a period of time. They were young men. Zwingli was the older guy. And they were drawn, he saw their talents and their gifts, and he drew them in. And what happened in 1524 and 1525 is that that relationship was broken. And you know how that can go. Someone with whom you are very close, for one reason or another, can ultimately become your opponent. And that's what happened in these circumstances. So we're talking about men who were important in their relationship to Huldrych Zwingli. I'll give you five names. The first one is Felix Mantz. Felix Mantz, his dad, his father, was a canon of the Grossmünster in Zurich. Now, the Grossmünster is the big church, the big important church. In fact, it's the church where Zwingli normally preached. And a canon was a Roman Catholic official who held a high position of authority within the cathedral. So Mantz is the son of someone who holds an important position. And you know how it works. Sons of important people tend to be prominent themselves just by identification with their father. So Felix Mons comes from this kind of a family. We don't know much about his education, except we know that he was well-trained and that he was able to read and speak Latin, Hebrew, and Greek. Those three languages were the classical languages of the day, and his ability to read and to speak them gives us evidence that he had been well-trained in university. The rest of them, we have much more information about who they were and what they were. Another man whose name is important is Conrad Grebel. We know something more about him. He was a student at the University of Basel, Basel being one of the major cities in Switzerland. Then he left Basel and he went to Vienna at the University of Vienna. And ultimately, he went to the University of Paris. So his step of education was going from a good university to one of the greatest universities in existence in the 16th century, the University of Paris. Now, he never graduated, and he was unconverted during his university days, and his father was somewhat disturbed by the looseness of his life as a university student. And in fact, his father made him return to Zurich. He grew up in Zurich, and he returned and was converted, and in 1521, he became a disciple of Zwingli. So Mons and Grebel were both in the inner circle of Huldrych Zwingli, learning and helping him in the process of Reformation. He was glad to rely on them. They worked together with him. A third man whose name we need to know is George Blaurock. Now, there's another German name by which he's known, but George Blaurock is probably the most common. And he was a graduate of the University of Leipzig. He was a priest in the Roman Catholic Church, so he had met the requirements of ordination in that church. And somewhere around 1520, he was converted, and he adopted Reformed views. And he had heard about Zwingli, and so he went to Zwingli in order to be in a place where the Reformed faith was beginning to be proclaimed, and he became involved with Felix Mons and Conrad Grebel. So these three men now, young men, but all of them with university education, with direct connections to the Roman Church, priesthood, well-trained, are coming together. In 1525, they held a debate with Zwingli, and the debate was over infant baptism, because the dangerous reality of people reading the Bible made these men question the practice of infant baptism. Now, you're getting the highlights here, but that's about 4 years after each of them came into the inner circle of Huldrych Zwingli. Now, Zurich was governed by a city council, and the city council had authority over the church. And so when this debate over infant baptism was held, it was held before the city council, and the city council decided in favor of the practice of infant baptism and against the practice of believer's baptism. Mons, Grebel, and Blaurock were unsatisfied with this, and so in 1525, in a private home, they baptized each other and began to form a church. Now, they're in a private home. They didn't have bathtubs or anything. Probably what they did was take a wet cloth and wash the face. We might not call that baptism, but they had no models to follow, and they called it a baptism because they were applying water to the body, and they believed that that was the sign of discipleship to Christ. All three of them, within 2 years, had been martyred because of their commitments to believers' baptism and their unwillingness to submit to the requirements of the city council. All three of them. Now, I'm going somewhere with this. The next man I want to mention, who also has a relationship to Zurich, and he's my favorite of the five, if I can have a favorite, is a man named Michael Sattler. Michael Sattler was a Benedictine monk, which means he had been well-educated and trained and accepted into the order of the monks. In many ways, like Luther was accepted into an order of monks. Well, he had a conversion experience, And he came to Zurich, and he was present in 1525. Now, that's the year when the debate was held and when Grebel and Mons and Blaurock were baptized by each other and formed what is effectively a Baptist church. Sattler comes to the city at right about that time. But the city council is so concerned with what is happening that they expelled Sattler and others who were not citizens of the city. They were, I guess, against immigration, and so we can relate to this somehow. They expelled Sattler, and so he had to leave. But he had been influenced by those three men, and in the next year, probably in 1526, he submitted to baptism. Now, he led a sort of a nomadic life from that point on, because if you had adopted the principles of Anabaptism, there were many, many places that were unwilling to allow you to be within their realms, their domains. But he eventually made his way to Strasbourg, which is on the Rhine. Now it's in France. Sometimes it has been in Germany in the past. But Strasbourg was the most accommodating city, probably in all of Europe, towards differences of religious belief. Many Anabaptists found their way to Strasbourg because they were not persecuted in Strasbourg the way that they were in other cities. And Sattler made his way there, and he made an acquaintance with the two important reformers in Strasbourg. You probably have heard the name Martin Bucer. The Banner of Truth, just within the last few years, published one of Bucer's books on the care of the soul. When Calvin was forced out of Geneva, he went to Strasbourg and sat under the ministry of Martin Bucer. Bucer is a very important reformer. He's not known as well as he ought to be. The other reformer in Strasbourg was Wolfgang Capito. So you have Capito and you have Bucer. And Michael Sattler develops a relationship with them. It's a good and positive relationship, a friendly relationship. He leaves Strasbourg, goes back to the south towards Switzerland, and he's involved with a group of men who publish what's called the Schleitheim Confession. But he was arrested by the Roman Catholic Austrian Habsburg authorities, imprisoned, and ultimately was martyred. But what's interesting about this is while he was imprisoned by the Habsburgs, Bucer and Capito wrote a letter to them on behalf of Michael Sattler. Now, these are well-known reformed reformers. I suppose that's redundant, but you know what I mean. Men of real standing in the Reformed faith. And they wrote a letter on behalf of Sattler to the Habsburg authorities, attesting to his character. Now, the letter says, we have some differences of opinion with Michael Sattler, but Michael Sattler is a godly man. Please don't treat him the way that you treat others. Of course, the Roman Catholics didn't pay any attention to the letter. But for me, it's very significant that these two men wrote that letter on his behalf. There's a connection here between the earliest Anabaptists and at least the Strasbourg reformers. Of course, Calvin married the widow of an Anabaptist, Idalette de Bure. Her first husband was an Anabaptist. Now, this letter from the Strasbourg reformers didn't help, and Sattler was cruelly burned at the stake in May of 1527, so the fourth of these five who were martyred. The fifth that I want to mention is a man named Balthasar Hubmaier. Don't you wish you named your kids Balthasar Hubmaier? Isn't one of the traditional names of the Magi Balthasar? I think so, yeah. He was a graduate of the University of Freiburg, where he earned a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. And then he earned a doctoral degree, PhD, at the University of Ingolstadt. And interestingly enough, his professor was a man named Johannes Eck. Does that name ring a bell with anybody, Johannes Eck? I'm sure you heard Dr. Godfrey mention that name. Eck was one of the most prominent Roman Catholics of the day. In fact, Eck debated Martin Luther, and he defeated Luther in debate because Eck knew the church fathers better than Luther did. So Johannes Eck was not a minor figure. Hubmaier earned his Ph.D. under Eck as his professor, and he became a priest in the Roman Catholic Church. In 1523, he seems to have adopted Anabaptist views, and guess where he went? He went to Zurich. All five of these have a relationship to Zurich. He was arrested, he was put under a great deal of pressure, and he actually recanted his views. But he was released from prison, expelled from the city, and he, I'm sure for longer than this, but he felt terribly guilty about the fact that he had recanted of views that he believed were taught in the scriptures and that were commanded by the Lord. And so he publicly repented of his recantation and returned to his Anabaptist roots. He went to Moravia, and then he was originally from Bavaria. He went to Moravia, and he enjoyed about a year of freedom Ingolstadt, I think. He had a great ministry there. Many people were baptized as a result of his ministry. But ultimately, he also was arrested by the Habsburg Austrian Roman Catholics, was cruelly tortured, and he was burned at the stake. And 3 days later, his wife was drowned in the Danube. They put a stone around her neck, threw her in the water, and she was killed. Now, there are common themes here. One common theme that's obvious is that they're all martyred. But let's probe into that a little bit more. I asked the question, why do I mention these five men? Well, the charges that are made against the Anabaptists, that they were ignorant and unlearned, and that their theology was poor and reactionary, are true if you ignore the first generation. But you see, the first generation, these five men, all involved in the work in Zurich, the early leaders were intellectuals, they were trained men, they were university graduates, some of them had been priests or monks in the Roman Church, and all of them died within 5 years of the start of the movement. Now think about this with me. What we call, I'm sure Dr. Godfrey used this phrase, the magisterial reformers. You recognize that phrase? That's a term that refers to reformers who acted out their ministry under the protection of whatever the government happened to be. So Luther had Frederick the Wise of Saxony, the Elector of Saxony, who protected him. And even that incident where Luther was kidnapped and sent off to the Wartburg Castle where he translated the Bible into German, remember that? That's because Frederick the Wise was concerned about his safety and orchestrated this kidnapping. It was a friendly kidnapping. And so Luther went and spent, you know, roughly a year in the Wartburg Castle and was able to work there. Calvin had the support of the city council in Geneva. So did Zwingli. Now Zwingli died on the battlefield fighting for the city of Zurich. But the magisterial reformers developed their theology under the protection of the state. Now we're coming up on, we're only a month away from what we call Reformation Day, right? October 31st, 1517, you've heard the story. Martin Luther nails the 95 Theses to the door at the Wittenberg Castle Church. You ought to read the 95 Theses. You can find them online. They're not what you think they are. Because we hear about Luther and we're told how he was railing against indulgences and all. Well, really what Luther is doing in the 95 Theses is writing against the misuse of indulgences. He continues even then to allow indulgences. It was the abuse of these things by the Roman Catholic Church that concerned Luther so much. Now that was leading towards the full Reformation. You even have to ask the question, when was Luther actually converted? When did he come to faith? And some Luther scholars argue that it's not until 1521. So the 95 Theses are 4 years, perhaps, prior to Luther coming to an understanding of justification by faith alone. Now, what's my point? My point is that Luther is a good example of a reformer who, under the protection of a powerful ruler, was able to think through his theology, develop it, and what we see as the mature Luther is not the same as what we might see in the early Luther. Now, when we come to Balthasar Hubmaier or Michael Sattler or Mons or Grebel or Blaurock, and we read their writings, we have to say it's true. They're not a full-blown understanding of the faith, justification by faith, and all the rest. But they never had the opportunity to sit quietly in a tower and translate the Bible and think through the Bible and come to full-blown conclusions. Almost immediately, they were being driven out of Zurich, they were facing persecution, and they all gave their lives. They did not have the opportunity that was given to Luther, to Zwingli, and to all the rest of the reformers who were in cities or in territories that were protected by a powerful ruler. Now, I can't tell you that Hubmaier or Sattler or the others would have developed a full-blown, thoroughgoing theology that we could recognize. I can't tell you that. But I can say this, when you look at the early writings of men like Luther, my son Micah did a paper on Zwingli when he was one of our students, and he and I worked through some of Zwingli's writings. They were in German, and we had to work at translating them, but we were able to do so. Zwingli himself had not yet come to a full-blown understanding of justification by faith alone. I wonder if time had been given and the opportunity had presented itself, whether or not these men might have advanced in their theology. So I want to give them a pass in that sense, because if Frederick the Wise had not protected Luther, all that we might have of Luther is the 95 Theses, and we would read them and we'd say, well, he's still making room for indulgences here. The early Anabaptists didn't have the privilege of the protection of the civil magistrate. That's why they're often called the radical reformers. They were outside of the power of the state. And so it's not a surprise that they did not develop a full-blown theology. Now, this is the conclusion to which I'm driving. See, when we look at the Anabaptist movement, we think about these five men, and they were the best of them. The leadership in the early days was stripped away. The trained men, the intellectuals, the men of substance and character were taken away within 5 years, and there was no one to fill the vacuum. So the leadership of the Anabaptist cause fell to merchants, and oftentimes it fell to peasants. And it was the undisciplined, untrained peasants and merchants who then began to move the Anabaptist movement into some strange areas. Now, I know someone could say, well, Thomas Munzer was a trained man and he went off the deep end. So was Karlstadt. He walked hand in hand with Luther and he went off the deep end. That's true. But these five men gave evidence of stability in terms of their commitment to Christ. They didn't lead people into strange ideas, and I want to give them the benefit of the doubt and suggest that they were on a trajectory that would have led them to orthodoxy. And so for that reason, when we look at the Anabaptist movement, I want to say we ought to honor the memory of those who gave their lives for their principles. We're not Anabaptists. We don't have any direct ties to them. But these five men, I really appreciate them and what they said and what they did, having some understanding of the circumstances in which they found themselves in the inner circle of Ulrich Zwingli and then driven out of that circle and ultimately put to death either by drowning or by being burned at the stake. But they were willing to do that because they were committed to what they saw in the Word of God. So that's what I wanted to say in addition. I don't know that Dr. Godfrey told that story. And again, I'm not blaming him at all. Okay? I love Dr. Godfrey. He's a personal friend. I don't doubt that everything that he said, which I don't remember, but I don't doubt that it was very good and true. But I want to tell this part of the story. because I think it is important. We need to keep it in mind. So when you hear those names of Conrad Grebel and Felix Manz and Balthasar Hubmaier and Michael Sattler and George Blaurock, thank God for their testimony and for their willingness. And give them a pass and wonder what might have been if they had had the privileges that Martin Luther had, being protected by such a powerful man as Frederick the Wise. So that's what I wanted to say about the Anabaptists. Anybody want to ask a question about that before I move on? I'm surprised, Jack. You want to ask a question? Wow. Jack and I have known each other for a long, long time. Did you listen to the Theology in Particular podcast on baptism? You hear we talk about mikvahs? You know where that came from?
Yes, I did.
That came from Jack a long time ago.
I knew you before.
Yep. Yeah, way back on Long Island. Yeah.
My question is, you draw a parallel historically that the magisterial reformers enjoyed protection, and these are Paedo-Baptists, as I understand.
Yes.
Baptizing children.
That's right.
Do you think they enjoyed some comfort, some protection, because they did not refute Catholic doctrines of infant baptism?
I think that was part of it, yes. And that's the problem with the Anabaptists, is that baptism was, and I will talk about this as we move forward, but baptism was in many ways the glue that held European society together. Maybe I'll say it here. When we are born, or our children are born, or our grandchildren, what kind of piece of paper do we get? A birth certificate, right? And who issues it?
State.
The state issues it. It's the local authority, whatever it happens to be, but they issue to us a birth certificate. In 1525 or in 1616, the state did not issue birth certificates. You know where your birth certificate was found? In the church book when you were baptized. Your christening gave you an official status as a citizen or subject of the kingdom. So to deny the importance of the christening in the church was effectively to untie society and set people loose. And that was considered in some ways to be treasonous. And that was a problem that the Anabaptists had to face, is that they were undoing something that was 1,000 years old and well established in European history.
Is this the first standing of adult or believer's baptism?
No. There are previous instances of believer's baptism. Henry of Lausanne in the 11th or 12th century seems to have developed a doctrine of believer's baptism. You know, my Presbyterian friends won't like me to say this, but when people read the Bible, they question the practice of infant baptism. And someone like Henry of Lausanne comes along and he reads it, and he had a doctrine of justification by faith before Luther, several centuries before Luther, and seems to have likewise denied the principle of infant baptism and begun to practice believer's baptism. But again, he's marginalized and perhaps even executed as a result of that. So there are some footsteps previously. He's a good example of it. Yeah.
I think that piece about the birth certificates is really helpful to understand why it was so severe that they would be willing to put them to death. Because if you don't have an understanding of the geopolitical ramifications,
that's right.
Of that,
that's right.
Like, why is that scary?
Yeah. You know, yeah. Church and state are one. They're one. You know, I can't understand why even today there are Christians who are advocating a merger of church and state. Every time in the last 2,000 years that has happened, it's been a disaster. Really, it's been a disaster. Pardon me?
Disasters never stop people from doing stuff.
No, you're right. You're
right.
Oh, of course, yeah. Oh, yeah. We won't make those mistakes, no. So let me move forward about 100 years in the time that's left to me. Thank you for letting me do that. I hope that that's an encouragement to you. We're not Anabaptists, but we owe it to these people to honor their memory. I really believe we do, because they believed in believer's baptism, even if it was just washing the face. They were committed to that principle, and they died for it. We ought to honor them. We're committed to the same principle. Fast forwarding about 100 years and coming across the English Channel to England. In 1616, There was a well-respected Puritan minister of the Church of England. His name was Henry Jacob. And Jacob, for a long time, had been an advocate and a defender and apologist for the Church of England. But he was persecuted and he was opposed by the bishops, and he came to the conclusion that he could no longer stay within the Church of England. And so in London in that year, 1616, he formed a church that we call a semi-separatist church. Now let me explain why we call it that. If you read some of the writings of the earlier separatists, their writings are razor sharp and condemnatory against the Church of England. They pulled no punches with the language that they used to say that the Church of England is a church of the devil. It goes on and on and on. But Jacob didn't believe that. He believed that he could no longer function as a minister in the Church of England, subject to the system of bishops and the king, again, a church-state relationship. But he knew that there were many true churches and many good men in the Church of England. And so while he could not participate in the system of the Church of England, he wouldn't condemn those who did. And so the church that he formed was unlike the other separatist churches in that it maintained friendly relationships with the Church of England and with the local parishes. In fact, baptisms were still performed by ministers of the Church of England for the members. So you've got Jacob's church and it's growing and people are having babies. Well, Jacob's not baptizing them. They're going down to the local parish and being enrolled and being baptized there. So the children are legal and they can inherit. That was an important part. If you've ever seen one of those old English stories, and the question of who can inherit, and they have to go back to the church books and find the names to legitimize the claim of inheritance. That's an example of what's going on here. In 1625, Henry Jacob emigrates to the New World. Guess where he came? Jamestown, Virginia. In fact, as far as I know, he's buried over there. It'd be interesting to see if we could find his grave. That would be fascinating, because he's an important part of our story. There you go, Ben. That's an assignment for you. Yeah, Sam is good. Yeah, you know that story. Yeah. He was followed by a fellow named John Lathrop, who in the 1630s, now you have to understand, this church is existing in the face of opposition in London. John Lathrop comes to be the pastor in the 1630s. He moves, he emigrates, and he comes to the Plymouth Colony. He's buried in Duxbury, Massachusetts. So you had Jacob come here, Lathrop go up to New England. The church exists at a time when there's a great deal of controversy in the Church of England itself. There was a man named William Laud, L-A-U-D, who was appointed the Archbishop of Canterbury. That's the top dog in the Church of England. If you watch the Queen's funeral, you saw Justin Welby, Archbishop of Canterbury, the most important clergyman in the whole church. William Laud held that position. And Laud was committed to two things especially. He was an Arminian, and he made it illegal for ministers of the Church of England to teach what we would call Calvinism. Okay, now, the 39 Articles, which is the doctrinal statement of the Church of England, is clearly committed to a predestinarian view of salvation. And Laud said, no, you can't interpret it that way. The other thing that he was committed to is what I call high church sacerdotalism. That's a big word. It simply means that the sacraments are the instruments through which grace comes. So infant baptism, in William Laud's view, looks very much like Roman Catholic infant baptism. Water is applied to the body, grace enters the heart of the child, and then the rest of the child's life is effectively earning salvation by being careful to follow the commands of the Church of England. It's not quite the full-blown sacramentalism of Rome, but it's pretty close. And he enforced these things on the Church of England. He's the top dog. He's the most powerful man in the church. This is in the 1630s. What happened in the 1630s? many, many of the Puritans fled to the Netherlands, but especially to New England. They came here to escape from the persecution of William Laud. Now, this church that I'm describing to you is at the center of it all because it's in London. So all of this is happening all around them. And they're struggling with what they see and what they should do. So in 1633, they have a church split. Don't think of it in the way that we think of church splits today. It wasn't necessarily nasty disagreements, but it was a separation. And the separation was over this issue. Should we bring our children to the local parish to be baptized? Now the semi-separatism is becoming a little bit more rigid separatism. And they're saying, if Archbishop Laud is imposing these things on the church, if we bring our children down there, are we participating in this Arminianism and this sacramentalism that is being promoted in the church? And there was a whole contingent of people in the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church, that's what we call it, the name of the three pastors. There was a contingent who were not comfortable with taking their children to be baptized in the parish church. So they separate from the church and they form a new congregation. Now the issue is not believers' baptism yet, but it is the legitimacy of baptism at the hands of a minister of the Church of England. You understand that? Okay. Now what that means for these people is, if they won't have their children baptized, now their children are no longer registered as legal subjects of the crown. And some of these were fairly wealthy people who were actually, because of their principles, putting themselves and their children in jeopardy. Their children couldn't inherit if they couldn't demonstrate the fact that they were legally subjects of the crown, but there would be no record of them in a parish church book. It took some guts to take this step. Okay, so now you have the church with Henry Jacob and then John Lathrop continuing on, but you have a separation with this discomfort. 5 years later, well, Henry Jesse comes to be the third pastor in 1637. And 5 years later, well, in 1638, 5 years after the first separation, there's a second separation. Now, remember what I said. William Laud is enforcing his views of infant baptism, his high church views of infant baptism on the church. So this is being debated in society and among Christians. It's pressure that they're coming under. So the people in now this church pastored by Henry Jesse, others are asking the question, not just can we take our children down to the local parish, but they're asking the question, should infants be baptized at all? Wait a minute, let's take a step back here. It's not just that we don't want to take our children down to St. John's on the corner. Should we take our children to a font anywhere? And so you have a debate that rages in the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church, and there's a second separation under the leadership of a man named John Spilsbury, in which now there's a church that's formed on the basis of believers' baptism. Now, let me say, there's no influence from the Continental Anabaptists at this point. This is a Puritan congregation committed to all of the principles of the Puritan faith. If you want to spend a lot of money, but read a really good book about this, Matt Bingham's book, Orthodox Radicals, it'll cost you $75 to $100, because sadly it's published by Oxford University Press, and it's a book that ought to be read by everybody. It's a fantastic book. Matt is a good friend, really appreciate his work. He lays this out really wonderfully. The church that develops is a church that is wholeheartedly committed to Puritan theology. What it rejects is the practice of infant baptism. So now what you have in London, you have three congregations. You have the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church, which continues. You have that 1633 separation that's over who should baptize. Now you have a 1638 separation over who should be baptized, and that baptism only belongs to believers. This church continues on. It by all accounts, we know that this was still not baptism by immersion. It's either, again, washing the face, or it might be what's called effusion. Effusion is where you take water and you pour it over the head of the person being baptized. It may be that that's what they did, a fusion. Well, the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church, this original church, continues to struggle with the question of baptism. And so around 1641, a group of men in the church are again asking the question about believers' baptism, but now they're asking the question, what is the mode of baptism? How should it be done? And they did something, I think, really that should be commended in the way that they handled this. One of the things that I really appreciate about the many of these guys in the 17th century is how they respected each other's consciences and how careful they were before they came to conclusions. So they held what was called conference. Now, this is not like the Keech conference. I have my Keech button on here. It's not like the Keech conference that we had yesterday, where four guys get up and they preached and it was really good, really edifying. To them, conference meant a discussion among the men of the church. They conferred with one another. And they took about a year to do this. Now, I can't give you the details, but this is what I imagine. That they came together weekly. I'm sure that was weekly. It would have to have been in an evening with candles in the room if it was wintertime. They did it for a year. And they brought their Bibles with them. And they worked their way together through all of the texts in the Old and New Testament that are relevant for baptism, asking the question, what conclusion should we come to about baptism? You know what? That's a great thing to do. It really is. They didn't quickly move. They worked through the Bible. But at the end of that year of conference, they came to the conclusion that believers' baptism was right and that believers' baptism should be done by immersion. Now, there's a whole lot more to the story. It's pretty fascinating. They tell us, we actually have firsthand accounts of this in manuscript form. I've got photographs of them on my computer. I've read them and worked with them. They acknowledge that no one in England at that time was baptizing by immersion. That's why we know that the Spilsbury Church was not practicing immersion yet. One of the $64,000 question is, after they accepted immersion, did the Spilsbury Church practice immersion? Well, yes, they did, but what about those people? Were they re-immersed? Let's not go there. But in January of 1642, and you've been in London before. When time of year were you in London?
October.
Anybody been there in January? It's cold, isn't it? And the sun is way down on the southern horizon. It comes up around 9:30 in the morning and sets around 3:30 in the afternoon. Cold day. 60 people, roughly, just under 60, were baptized by immersion in one of the tributaries of the Thames in London. Wow. So now what we have in 1642 is a Puritan church that is committed to the principle of believers' baptism by immersion. And so far as we can tell, this final step made sense to so many that as the churches begin to develop, they all begin to practice believers' baptism. Now, by 1644, 2 years later, there are seven churches in London, seven of these Puritan, Calvinistic, predestinarian churches in London. And Parliament and the Westminster Assembly, which is meeting at the time, is concerned about them because they've heard all the bad stories about the Anabaptists on the continent. They've heard about the disaster in Munster and all the rest. So they demand that these seven churches declare openly their principles. And so what they did was they published a confession of faith. They wrote it in about 6 weeks, and it was published. There were watchers, and these watchers criticized it. So what did the Baptists do? They revised it. And they revised it according to the criticisms that were made by their opponents. It's actually very interesting. I know a guy who wrote a book called For the Vindication of the Truth that deals with all of these things. Some of you may have read it. I don't know. From 1649, when King Charles I was tried and executed, until 1660, and this is more or less the era of Oliver Cromwell, the Baptists had freedom. And they grew enormously. By 1660, now This is in the span of less than 20 years. They went from 7 churches in London to about 120 churches around the country. Many of them, not all of them, but many of them were formerly pedo-Baptist churches who had been convinced of believers' baptism by immersion, and they came over to Baptist principles. Of course, by 1660, when Charles II is, you know, it's interesting. London or England has never had a good King Charles. Just think about that for a few moments. In 1660, when Charles II was restored to the throne, a period of persecution began, and it lasted until 1688. And the churches struggled under that period of persecution, though they grew. We continue to see growth. By the time you get to about 1715, there are around 200 churches committed to our confession of faith in England. It's a pretty amazing story, really. Now, time is up. Should I give a question or two an option? I mean, there's so much more that we could say. Yeah, but we do need to stop so we can begin to come to worship. Any questions? Go ahead, Mike. No, that's the Little Ice Age and the Maunder Minimum. Yeah, okay. Scientists have shown that for a period of about from 1350 to 1850, climatologists have demonstrated that the Northern Hemisphere went through a lengthy period of cold. Prior to 1350, there were vineyards in England. But after about 1350, the vineyards die off because the climate changed. Is climate change real? Well, it was then. The climate changed, and the vines couldn't grow anymore. That's why Northern Europe has a grain-based alcohol culture. Southern Europe has a wine-based alcohol culture, because they could continue to grow the vines. Well, anyways, there was an 80-year period from about 1645 to 1725, or whatever 80 years is, that it's demonstrated those were the coldest times during the Little Ice Age. And so this baptism ceremony is just at the beginning of the Maunder Minimum. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So they were really committed to go down to the Thames and baptize by immersion. Yeah. Fellow in the back, what's your name?
My name is still Jack.
Okay. That's a good question. If it were the pedo-Baptist, I would say don't let your commitment to infant baptism make you think that your child is a Christian. Your child is a sinner who needs Christ. And preach Christ to your child and bring your child to a church where Christ is preached. It doesn't make them into a Christian. And sadly, there are some who say that. See, that's a problem that exists even today. I would say that. To the credo Baptist who might look longingly at the practice of infant baptism, I would say the same thing. Infant baptism doesn't do anything. For a brief period of time, my family attended a Presbyterian church. We hadn't yet found a home church when we had moved many, many years ago in the 1990s. We were in a Presbyterian church and there's an infant baptism. And on the way home, I said to the kids, "What happened there? What happened to that baby?" And they didn't know what to say. And I said, "Well, it got wet. And it cried. But that's all that happened." Now, to the parents, this was a romantic, wonderful time in which now our baby is the Lord's, et cetera, et cetera. Because I do something to my child, it's my work, I asked the minister to apply water to the baby. Does that put grace into the heart, or does that put that child into a circumstance in which we can call them Christians? I want to say, no way. That contradicts the gospel. And yet our beloved friends, remember, I spent 20 years living with Presbyterians. I love them, but they're really inconsistent at that point. So I would warn Credo Baptist parents not to be taken in by the sort of the sentimental, romantic idea of infant baptism. It doesn't do anything. It's not objective. It's just my action. I had five kids. If I had baptized them as infants, actually rantized them, to be technical, wouldn't have done anything to their hearts. They still would need Christ. You know, it's interesting that in most of the pedo-baptist churches, they make a distinction between baptism and the Lord's Supper. And in order to come to the Lord's table, you have to make a profession of faith. You know what that is? That's a dry believer's baptism. It really is. Just like dedication of infants is a dry infant baptism. You know, that's what that is. I wish that our Presbyterian friends would be more consistent and not just have, and bring the two together so that the young people who make a profession of faith are baptized. That's where you make your profession of faith. That's where you say, Jesus is Lord. Does that answer your question, Jack?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. All right, I think we should probably stop here because of time.
Thank you so much, brother.
Yep. Yes.